Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Nebraska is now open for the transaction of business. Draw nigh, all ye having business with this honorable court, and ye shall be heard. God save the State of Nebraska and this honorable court.
Thank you. You may be seated. Good morning to everyone. We will begin with introductions from the court. I am Mike Havigan, the Chief Justice, and now by order of seniority as to service on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning. I'm Lindsay Miller-Lerman.
William Castle. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Stephanie Stacy.
Good morning. I am Jeff Funk.
Jonathan Papik. Good morning.
And John Frankenberg.
Thank you, members of the court. Well, I guess I should note a little bit of business here today. Justice Miller-Lerman is recused in the second and third cases of the day, and the court will be joined by District Court Judge Carson from Kearney. And in the very last case of the day, I am recused, and Justice Stacy is recused, and Judge Carson will join us again, and Judge Butler from Grand Island will join us, and Justice Miller-Lerman will preside on that last case. With that in mind, the first case of the day is Slama versus Slama. Counsel, you may... So, Mr. Breezy, are you here today?
Yes.
Good morning. And Mr. Holloway, you are also here today?
Yes, I am.
And are you going to split time?
Yes, Your Honor.
And is that 5 minutes and 5 minutes?
Yes.
Okay. And are you going to want rebuttal time also?
Yeah, reserve up to 1 minute of time for rebuttal.
Okay.
If I have to.
Good. And you have to keep track of that time. The bailiff does not keep track of that. The bailiff keeps track of rebuttal time, but not the five and five split.
Okay. I'll watch it. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
And Mr. Fitzgerald, you're here today. And also, is it Mr. Weeks?
Good morning, Your Honor.
And you're going to split time, too. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Five and five?
Yes.
And you also have to keep track of that. And Mr. Weeks, you're going to go first. Is that
correct? Yes, Your Honor.
Do any counsel have any other questions before we begin? If not, then Mr. Breezy, good morning again to you. You may approach and you may proceed.
Good morning, everyone. May it please the court. My name is David Breezy. I represent the appellant, John Sandahl. I reserve up to 1 minute of my time for rebuttal. This case concerns approximately 220 acres of farm ground in Wayne County. The Slama siblings inherited eight parcels of farm ground from their father. Upon his death, they had some dispute about how to distribute that farm ground and other things, and so a real estate agreement was signed, among other agreements between the siblings, where the farm here, one of the parcels of the farm, was distributed or transferred to Norman Slama. And in that real estate agreement, Norman Slama also gave a right of first refusal to his siblings in the event that he received a purchase or an offer to purchase his farm ground. He would then give a right of first refusal and communicate such offer to his siblings. And then they would have 14 days to exercise that right. Norman Slama did receive a purchase offer from John Sandahl, his tenant that had been farming the ground since 2015. And it was for $10,000 per acre. It was for approximately 226 acres minus a building site that was to be surveyed and then kept by Norman. So then Norman sent a notice of right of first refusal to his siblings by certified mail that summarized that purchase offer. The Salama siblings then failed to exercise the right of first refusal. However, the district court found otherwise and required that the notice of right of first refusal contain information concerning the lease that was between John Sandahl and Norman Salama. The problem is that the real estate agreement does not require every term of the purchase agreement to be contained in the notice of right of first refusal. It simply requires that the purchase offer be communicated, which it was. Well-settled Nebraska contract interpretation law.
So the property was subject to a lease?
It was subject to a lease, yes.
So there would be a lease for that year of purchase?
Correct.
And so whoever would purchase it would take subject to that lease?
Correct.
Is that a material item or piece of the information?
Well, it's a financial factor like anything.
It's possession, isn't it?
It is possession.
If somebody's buying it, they're not buying it and having immediate actual possession. They're buying it subject to a lease.
Yes.
Would that be material to a potential purchaser to know that?
It is material. The point being, though, is that that's not what's required from the real estate agreement and the right of first refusal. And that was not contained in the purchase offer, that the lease was not contained in it, so it was not required.
So it was just a fact known between Mr. Sandahl and Mr. Salama. Is that right?
The
lease.
The lease.
Existence of the lease?
The existence of the lease, yes.
Did the other parties know about the lease?
Well, I think there's a genuine issue of material fact that they knew that there was a lease. And I think that's, it's borne out in the briefs, in the record.
And I think Justice Funk's questions may be hitting on, is it material?
Is it material? Is it material? Yeah, I mean, certainly. I mean, you would want to know that if you're purchasing the property. However, again, that's not required, and we're back to...
But what you might want to know and that which is required by documents may differ.
The documents differ, but is it required? I would say no, it's not, because of the overwhelming majority of courts out there say that, that adequate notice that have addressed this say that, you just have to provide potential, or you have to provide actual notice of potential sale, and then just information that's sufficient for that right holder to determine if they're interested in purchasing the property. Well, the notice of right of first refusal did that in this case. $10,000 per acre. They're approximate acres, but they were told of that. So, but that's in that. So it's sufficient information.
How does a court determine or the law determine what is material and what is not?
Well, there's cases out there, Justice, that talk about what's material. Price is material. That's all material. But I think the point is that it's not required to be provided as the notice. The other parties could have contacted their brother. They could have contacted the attorney. They didn't. They sat on their hands. They slept on their rights. They didn't contact them to even determine what the purchase price was always going to be an issue.
So your argument is materiality doesn't make a difference, and besides, they waived it.
It does make a difference, and yes, they waived it based on the majority of overwhelming cases that's required that require them to investigate if there's an unclear term in the purchase agreement or in the notice of right of first refusal. And so, with that, I would I request that the court reverse the district court's order on the summary judgment and remand and allow Mr. Sandahl to purchase the farm ground based on his purchase agreement that he had with Mr. Salama. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Holloway. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you, Justices. May it please the court. My name is Keelan Holloway, and I represent Norman Salama, the owner of the farm ground in dispute. I see the time has picked up a little bit. I've lost a bit of time here, so I will not reserve any time for rebuttal, and I'll highlight my three main issues I'd like the court to focus on. Initially, I'll list them, and then I'll address them separately. The district court order is contrary to the express terms of the right of first refusal. The second issue is the district court improperly assumes a factual issue which arose once the district court voided and deemed unenforceable the only third-party offer that was out there. And finally, the district court should have halted the summary judgment inquiry when the record discloses an issue of fact as to Joe's knowledge of the lease. To address your concerns, Your Honors, questions you pose about the materiality of the lease issue, I believe that is relevant to the decision to buy or sell, and that was disclosed to them on March 22nd. In the 31-day period from March 3rd to April 3rd, where the right of first refusal provides that they have 14 days to accept, an effective exercise must be received within 14 days, Norm heard nothing from anybody, and John is the only one that made a commitment and paid the earnest deposit to buy the farm. Joe never once in that same period contacted Norm or myself, his attorney, and asked any questions, anything. All communication with Joe and Ken were through Ken.
So do you agree or disagree that the lease was a material term of the sale of the property?
I agree that it was a material factor of the sale.
Seems like you're saying, but March 22nd, everybody knew about the lease.
Yeah.
That should be the date the district court considered whether there was an acceptance of the offer.
That is correct, Your Honor. I believe March 22nd at the latest, there are arguments that notice was given earlier, but March 22nd means an effective acceptance would have to be received by April 5th, and there was no effective acceptance. The only certified acceptance that was received on April 8th.
Anything happened between March 22nd and April 5th that would have been an issue that potential purchasers would have been concerned about? I.e., was there a sale or a purchase agreement signed?
A purchase agreement was signed. However, if you look at Standard Insurance, the case that I cited in my brief, the court said that the effective exercise needed to be given during the option period and money paid into the court. In this case, I don't see why John and Norm's private agreement to meet and sign the agreement prevented anybody from giving a notice or sending a certified mail that they accept their right of first refusal.
Well, there's some indication that there was a drop dead date of 5 p.m. on April 3rd. Is that right?
Yes, I told Ken on March 31st, he had the agreement in his hands, the identical agreement that was signed by John on March 22nd, and it was unsigned. Nothing was signed. We heard nothing. And I told him, I contacted him on March 31st and said, we need to know by close of business on April 2nd. He said in his deposition that he would have told Joe about that deadline. And the phone records support that. I would also point out, I've got just a few seconds, but there is a factual issue as to Joe's knowledge of the lease. The court questioned her recollection of the 86-minute phone call with Ken and found that her explanation with regard to fail to get the mailing was not credible. She also had an admission after the lawsuit was filed that she deemed her effective date as March 22nd. That admission, the record, we would argue is a factual issue that should have been tried. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Weeks.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning to you.
May it please the court, I'm Andrew Weeks with Baylor Ebnin, and I represent Joe Slama, who is the plaintiff in the below action. This case involves either a knowing concealment of material terms and conditions related to a right of first refusal, or a completely second offer with different material terms and conditions than were originally disclosed to the right holders. Viewed either way, the district court's order granting summary judgment in favor of Joe Slama should be affirmed. Unlike the appellant that solely relies on paragraph 1E for his position, that material terms and conditions were not required to be disclosed, the district court properly interpreted both paragraph 1D and 1E of the agreement together. The plain language of the agreement then does require that whatever terms and conditions were offered by the purchaser of the property were to be conveyed. Neither the March 1st purchase offer, which was not originally disclosed by Mr. Holloway, nor the March 1st, 2021 letter referenced several material terms of the actual agreement that was entered into by Mr. Sandahl and Norman Slama. Neither referred to the fact that it was subject to a lease. Neither referred to the fact that there would be a kickback in the in form of cash rent.
Is the lease material, and is that, then I guess you're telling us that it is, it had to be disclosed.
Yeah, I think a lease is material. I think you heard Mr. Sandahl's counsel today admit that it's material, and I just think that is common sense that anybody who believes or is under the impression that they are paying a certain price for a fee simple interest in property only to find out later that in fact they don't have a possessory interest that they believe they were paying to for would be material. And I think that
how much was the lease worth in dollars for a year?
How much was the cash rent?
Yes.
A little over $70,000.
And what was the entire purchase price of the property?
It was about $2.2
million. So is $70,000 material as compared to $2 million?
I think so, Your Honor. I think any time, and I cited a case to the court where they talked about a material price difference, and that was, in my brief, I pointed out that was less than a 1% difference in price. Here, that $70,000 would represent more than a 3% decrease in price from what was conveyed to the right holders.
So is material defined exclusively by the right of first refusal documents, or is materiality imposed on that document by case law?
I think it's both, Your Honor. I think it's clear that this court has decided in Walters v. Spohr that a right of first refusal is a non-vested property interest. So in addition to whatever contract the parties enter into, whatever terms and conditions they agree to, there's also a body of case law that defines what a right of first refusal are and also defines what certain obligations are imposed by right of first refusal. In that same case, it is essentially defined as the right to elect to take a specified property at the same price and on the same terms and conditions. So I think in addition to the agreement that the parties enter into, there is a body of case law that also impose obligations on...
to disclose conditions. It's not just price per acre.
Well, to disclose material conditions.
Material.
Yes. And I think, Judge, at that point, if you look at page 426 of the transcript, which is part of the district court's order, he has a line in there that Norman failed to communicate to them all the material terms of Sandahl's offer sufficient to qualify as a reasonable disclosure of the offer. And that's where you get into some of the cases cited by Mr. Sandahl. When we talk about what is a reasonable disclosure, I consider that to be kind of in the materiality family. In other words, what information does that party need to help them make a decision of whether they want to exercise their right of first refusal. So I think the materiality and the reasonable disclosure with the terms and condition are all kind of tied together.
Because what you're aiming to forestall is someone saying, oh, if I knew that, I would have exercised.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
If nobody has any further questions at this time, I will yield the rest of my time to Mr. Fitzgerald. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Fitzgerald, good morning to you.
Good morning, Chief Justice. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I am Mark Fitzgerald. I'm representing the appellee, Ken Slama. The law in the jurisdictions that have decided this case is squarely in favor of the appellees here. And we've cited numerous cases in our brief, and we believe that the two most helpful are the Cook case and the Packard case. They frame the issue slightly differently, but really it's the same issue. The Cook case, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals says, asks, when does the right, or when does the right holder, the people in the position of Ken and Joe, have a duty to investigate? The court answers that and says, after reasonable notice. In other words, the seller has the first obligation to give reasonable notice. The Packard case asks, what type of notice triggers the right holder's obligation to respond? The Packard case answers that when there is notice sufficient to enable the holder to decide. That would encompass the material terms. The reported cases...
I'm sorry to interrupt. Justice before State. There was notice provided of the offer here, did the rest of the siblings have notice of the lease by virtue of a different provision in the agreement? Did no. they just walking around have notice that there was a lease?
Right. No, they didn't. They
Why
didn't
not?
Have notice of the lease. Because they didn't know that.
Were they not provided the right of first refusal for the leases?
The right of first refusal.
Didn't the agreement provide for the right of first refusal to leases on the individual parcels?
I do not believe it does. I may be mistaken.
If it does, what impact, if any, does that have on your notice argument?
I don't believe that it has any impact because it is a material term to a sale. It is a material term to a sale along the lines of what we've been talking about. The reported cases make sense because the seller is the master of the notice. The seller knows all of the facts. The seller has a duty to disclose the material terms of the contract, the purchase offer, to the right holders. We say, and Sandal, the appellant, denies this in Sandal's brief, but attempted to make that argument again here today, that essentially the extension of the seller's argument here, or Sandal's argument here, is that the right holder is always under a duty to inquire, always under a duty to inquire, and that's not what the law requires. The law requires the disclosure of the material terms to the right holders. And if you attempt to summarize, the seller does that at the seller's risk, not the buyer, not the right holders. And then Sandal attempts to make the argument here today that the language of the document itself, the 2000 agreement, the language of the document itself requires only that the offer, he says in the brief and today, be communicated. Well, it actually says such offer be communicated, and it is not reasonable under the case law and not reasonable under the facts of this case to say that all Norman had to do was, dear Joe and Ken, I have an offer on the property, and then require that Joe and Ken do all of the investigation based on that. That's not what the document itself requires, and that's not what the law requires.
Did the appellees, they made a request to exercise the right of first refusal, which the appellants are saying was out of time, correct?
Yes.
What was there about this term that we're talking about, this material term, that would have made the appellees try to exercise it quicker?
Yeah. There was a term with regard to price. Essentially, the lease is a price term. It is a 70 $1,000 to $72,000 or $3,000 difference as far as price. And that's material.
A price increase or a price decrease?
A price decrease. If Mr. Sandal got his lease money paid in advance back, it's a $70,000 to $72,000 difference, lower price, available to Mr. Sandal. That's material.
Now, isn't it true that there's no way that the terms could be exact between the appellees and the seller of the property as it was between the appellee and the leaseholder, because it's a different relationship? You have to account for that lease as a leaseholder. So those terms couldn't have been exact between the two agreements.
If the notice had summarized and said subject to lease, that may have put us on duty to make further inquiry. If I answered your question, just for
you. Is there some dispute about when your clients actually got notice? And
I think that with regard to my client, Ken, Judge Kubey said on March 22, he actually got a duplicate unsigned copy of the purchase agreement that was ultimately signed by Sandal and Norman Slama. So March 22 for my client. By April 3, they had already executed the purchase agreement, Sandal and Norman, and consequently, Ken was not given the 14 days permitted under the 2000 agreement to give notice of his intention to buy the property. Thank you, Chief Justice.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal. So, counsel, that concludes arguments in Slama versus Slama. You are excused. And the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is Preserve the Sandhills LLC versus Cherry County, Nebraska. As earlier noted, Justice Miller Lerman is recused from this matter, and Judge Carson, District Court Judge for the 9th Judicial District in Kearney, is going to be joining us here in just a second.